Culinary Libertarian Podcast, Episode 8.
Hey folks, welcome back to the podcast. Happy to be here and happy to have you here. A couple of details before we get started. Head over to culinarylibertarian.com/podcast and like me on social media. You can also support the show with Patreon, and if you support at the $3 or $5 level, I'll send you a Culinary Libertarian bumper sticker or coffee mug, respectively. Lastly, find and like the show on iTunes and give me a review. That'll help move the show up and get some more people listening to learning how to cook. You can find the details about this episode on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/8. So today I want to talk about soup. Now that we're getting into cooler weather, at least in my neck of the woods, it's certainly more soup weather than in the middle of August. I see lots of cooks struggling with flavor. How do I, says our fictitious cook, get soup to taste good? Well, that's a pretty good question. And the same principles that apply to making a soup taste good are the same things that we're going to use when we do a braise. Say we make veal ossobuco or short ribs or a stew, or even if we're cooking some chicken breasts or a veal scallopini or a piece of fish in a saute pan, the stuff that's left behind, there's always going to be some little bits. The little bits are what the French call the fond, F-O-N-D, which is the foundation. That's the base for the flavor. How we get that out of the pan and into the bowl and into our tummies is the process we're going to talk about today, which is making that flavor come alive, come out, come, you know, into our bowl, into our food, into our mouth. Yum, yum. So let's talk a little bit about soup nomenclature. There are a wide variety of kinds of soups. It can be pretty simple. We can have thin soup or thick soup. So a consommé is probably the most elegant of the thin soups. Thick soups would be cream soups, chowders, gumbos. We can distinguish soups between cream soups, cream of potato soup, or broth soups, beef vegetable. Then we do have some kinds of specialty things. A chowder is a kind of a specialty soup. There are some give and play on what the definition is of a chowder. To me, a chowder really has to have potatoes and bacon, and everything after that can or cannot be. For example, a clam chowder. A Manhattan clam chowder is red from lots of tomatoes. A New England clam chowder is creamy, and everybody is probably mostly familiar with the New England style of clam chowder. There is a class of soup in the Escoffier book, La Guide Culinaire, called the potage. Potage is another word for soup, and in some senses, it is exactly the word for soup, so I can't make the argument about it. I can just tell you what's in the book. We also have the gumbo, which is a kind of a specialty soup, partly, I think, this is conjecture, for the thickener used, which is a really dark roux. The previously mentioned consommé, which is a clarified soup. Clarified in the sense of a soup means that all of the particles, every little teeny bit of cloudiness and stuff is removed, and it's removed in a fashion by using something called a raft. And a raft is going to have egg whites and protein, either ground beef for a beef consommé or ground fish or ground chicken for fish or chicken consommé, lots of vegetables, lots of flavor, and consommés start with an excellent well-made stock, and then from that, we're going to go forward. Now, I'm not going to talk about making consommé on this episode because it's a very expensive thing to make because you have to make the stock, cool the stock, and more vegetables, more meat, more stuff. So between time and ingredients, there's just a lot to do to make a consommé. If you're in a restaurant and they offer a consommé, I would recommend trying it because it's sort of amazing how something that appears as fluid as water can have so much flavor. That's really the beauty of a consommé. Crystal clear and free of fat and astonishing amounts of flavor. We're not going to do that today, but if you get there, it's worth trying. Wherever it is, you may end up having that soup. There are lots of ways for confusion to take place. One of the things I think happens is a quality of ingredient problem. If you need to purchase commercial made stock or broth because you cannot or don't want to, or whatever the reasons are, don't want to make your own at home, as a home cook, that's perfectly fine. There is a standard which I hold for restaurants to be, it's a high standard. And I have a high expectation of good restaurants. And I have a fairly high expectation of myself at home. But I also recognize that there are lots of challenges that get in the way between sports and school and kids and work. And, well, sometimes we just can't do all the things we want to do. Convenience does offer a solution, and the solution is to use some commercially made stocks. And if that's the thing that needs to happen for cooking to take place, well, then do the thing that makes cooking take place. A little bit about my background, just so you understand what my knowledge base is in terms of soup. My training was with a couple of certified master chefs, and I've been cooking for 30-ish years and spent a lot of time working through and in culinary school teaching as a chef instructor the classical French book I mentioned a minute ago, La Guide Culinaire. Auguste Escoffier is one of the patriarchs of cooking. Antonin Carême would be another one from a couple hundred years ago. Escoffier codified really the procedures for what really fine cooking is. And it is from this place that I come with knowledge about flavor and building soups and sauces and all this stuff. When we get into soup making, we're going to have mostly two bases. Either it's going to be a stock-based or a broth-based soup, or it's going to be a dairy-based soup, cream or milk. The thickener we're going to use mostly, if it's going to be thickened soup, is going to be a roux. Now, roux is a mix of equal parts by weight of flour and butter. At home, we're going to use whole butter, which is how the butter comes out of the box in the little wrappers. For our needs, we do not use margarine. Margarine should be avoided at all costs. Butter is by far the superior choice. If you are making a roux for a chowder and you happen to be a person who saves bacon fat, well, the bacon fat would be an excellent choice in a case of a chowder for the thickening agent. So what's going to happen, we're going to heat the butter or bacon fat, well, the butter until it melts, heat the bacon fat up and add our flour. So let's say we have 2 ounces of butter. We're going to add 2 ounces of flour, and as it starts to mix in the pan, what's going on inside the pan is the butter is coating every one of those little teeny tiny flour particles with a little bit of fat. And you'll see some cookbooks, or in the case of a gumbo, which is the special roux, we want to cook that roux at least a minute. We want to cook that on kind of low to medium heat. What can happen on really high heat is things go from no color at all to being browned or black and burnt. And when things get burnt, there is no retreat. There's garbage and start over. Slower is better. Heat and the browning process are cumulative. It may take longer over slower time to brown the roux if that's what we're looking for, but slow is better, certainly when we're learning what we're doing and building the flavors, because burn's bad. So let me divert a minute to the gumbo roux. A gumbo roux is going to be nearly burnt, but not burnt. It's going to be as dark as coffee grounds. It has an aroma that is really difficult to describe, but the aroma of that very dark roux is also the flavor of the very dark roux, and that's one of the main components to a gumbo. It needs to have that, well, we'll say rather peculiar taste, because mostly we don't eat things that are cooked that dark. It's not burnt, but maybe two steps away from that. The other things in gumbos are going to be okra and sassafras. Sassafras in the powdered form also goes by the name of gumbo filet, and that's also a thickening agent, but it adds another element of flavor. We'll make gumbos a separate episode, but for now, that's what we need to know. If we want to make stock, stocks being the base of flavor for our soup, or if we're doing some fancier cooking, that could be the base of flavor for our sauce. Stock is the liquid extraction of flavor from the bones of the animal. So beef stock is made from beef bones, but kind of the secret is, it's not. It's made from veal bones. Beef bones tend to be a little bit more expensive, and so that, from a restaurant standpoint, that raises the price of everything in the associated with the dish. The bigger problem with beef bones is, they're harder to come by, and two, they have a higher amount of fat in them, which isn't altogether a problem, but it doesn't end up producing a spectacular beef stock. And most restaurants use veal bones for that, and they will roast the bones until they're nice and dark, roast the vegetables until they're nice and dark, and a veal stock will cook on the stove anywhere from 10 to 12 hours, sometimes a little bit longer, to get all of the collagen out of the bones and to get all the flavor out of the bones, and that takes a long time for something as strong as a veal bone. If you're going to make chicken stock, which you can make from chicken carcass if you are a person who buys whole chickens to save money or to get the flavor from the bird. Chicken bones, either raw or if you roast the whole bird, save the bones, just like you would save the bones from turkey at Thanksgiving time, make a stock out of that. So now you have turkey soup. Do the same thing with chicken. You can do that with fish. I think people probably avoid buying whole fish for lack of knowing what to do with it, but the principle applies. The big thing that's different from a chicken stock to a veal stock is the cooking time. A chicken stock would cook, depending on what you're using, but really I would not cook a chicken stock more than 2 or 3 hours, just to keep a brighter, cleaner flavor on it. The broth is a similar idea, but broth is made from at least the meat of the animal. So if you have lots of chicken trim, say you, some reason, have many pounds of chicken breasts that you bought from the grocery store, and they all come with that little rib meat stuck on the side, well, you're going to trim all that off, you're going to trim little fat bits off. Well, all that stuff is flavor. So put that in a pot of some water and some aromatics. Aromatics are the vegetables, carrots, celery, onions, and then we can sort of get fancier, not fancier, but we can expand the flavor profile from those three things. Carrots, celery, onions is called mirepoix. We can add fennel and leeks and parsnips and mushroom stems to add a depth of flavor to our stock or to our soup, which once we have a better flavored stock or soup, we'll just say stock, then we are going to end up having a better soup or a better sauce, whatever we're making. So the foundation of the thing is going to be the stock. So the better that is, the better our final product is going to be. We've got the roux, or the idea of the roux. We've got the stock made. If we're going to use milk, we're going to use milk. I would recommend whole milk, high-fat milk. I would not use cream as the main base. I would use cream as a last addition, just to give it an extra punch of fat, because cream is anywhere from 34 to 40% butterfat, and whole milk is 3 to 4% butterfat. So that extra richness, but this would be a case of definitely having too much of a good thing. I think a cream soup made actually all from cream, it just would not sit nicely in the tummy. All right, so let's say we're making a beef soup. So we're going to go to the store, and they do sell beef stew bits. I don't see anything wrong with buying beef stew bits. If you're a person who knows how to cut up meat into bite-sized bits and you know what piece you want to have, there's no reason not to do that, but they've made it fairly easy. So we have our beef bits, and we have our mirepoix. are carrots, celery, and onions. And if you want the leeks and the fennel and the parsnips, that's fine too. The base for flavor begins with that clean pan or a clean pan. We didn't talk about pans yet. And just real quickly, a thicker bottomed pan is more important than thicker walls, because the thicker the bottom, the more it diffuses the heat evenly and doesn't have as many hot spots, is far superior than those really thin stainless steel pans, which get hot very quickly but have hot spots and are prone to burning things in certain areas, and it just, they are not all that well suited for consistency. So I prefer a thick bottomed pan for whatever it is I'm cooking, because it holds heat and it doesn't burn. Well, can, but not as easily. We have our hot pan. Into our hot pan, and how hot is a hot pan? Well, when you add your oil, I'm not using whole butter here because whole butter will burn quickly, because the milk solids in the butter will burn and that's bad. I would use bacon fat. I would use olive oil. I would even use extra virgin olive oil. And yes, I know, I can already hear you. Oh my gosh, he's doing what? Yeah, I would do that. I would use peanut oil. I personally would stay away from soybean oil, and I would stay away from canola oil. A little bit of fat in the bottom of the pan. If it starts to smoke a little bit, that's okay. This is where having organization is really critical. And I used that phrase at the beginning of the episode, mise en place. That means having everything together, everything ready to go. So the meat is out of the package, the plastic is thrown away, all of your vegetables are cut. If you're using fresh herbs, those are ready to go. You've got water, because we do use water as the base for a stock, if we're making stock, or we have our stock at the ready if we're making soup. Everything's ready to go. So the pan's hot, the oil's in, it's smoking a little bit. Carefully add the meat to the pan with the oil. Now, don't drop it in, and certainly don't throw it in, because it may splash oil back at you. If you have it in a bowl, put the bowl near the fat, near the bottom of the pan, and just tap it out, and it's going to make a big hissing sound, and the oil is going to fly all over the place, and you're going to see smoke, and lots of things are going to be happening. That's okay. What we want to have happen is we want the high heat of the pan to sear the meat and give it a deep brown color. Now, there are gradations of brown, and as long as we're not burning it, we're okay. Well, that's fine, Reed, but my pan was too hot, and I burnt my meat a little bit. Well, burnt we don't want, but we're not going to worry too much about that, because the other thing that's going to happen, as you add all of that room temperature meat, say it's 70 degrees, to that 400 and plus degree pan, sort of the basics of physics math is that cold of 70, which is only relatively cold compared to 400, is going to make 400 drop a lot. So you're going to end up seeing some water coming out of the meat and in the form of bubbling, steaming juice, and that's lowering the heat of the pan, so you're not going to burn your meat. Stir the meat, season the meat a little bit. We want to just get a nice, even, dark color with a slotted spoon. Take the meat out of the pan into a different bowl, clean bowl. Now, what should remain in the pan are the bits from what you just seared, and possibly, depending on how fatty the meat was, some beef fat left over. I can't tell you how much is too much for you. If you prefer, you may dump all of the oil out and start with fresh oil, but keep all the little nice brown bits in the pan, because when we put that back on the stove, add a little bit of new oil, bacon fat, peanut oil, whatever you're using. Now add the carrots. The order of addition for the aromatics is going to make a difference in how we get the most flavor from our soup. Carrots and celery, obviously you know this, they're very dense, hard vegetables, as the onion, although it seems like it is, really is not. And the onion has a lot of water that's easy for heat to make release. Well, what does that mean? As you're cooking your vegetables on that high heat, the celery and the carrots, and if you're using them, parsnips, and to some degree fennel, they have a lot of vegetable stuff, cellulose, to get through that has to be cooked down, so that as those cellulose cells deteriorate and start to break down from the cooking, they're going to release their water. Now, celery has a lot more available water than a carrot does, but because the carrot is so strong, it's going to take longer for it to brown than it will take for the onion to brown. So carrots, then celery, then onions, but look at the vegetables in the pot, see if they're starting to brown, then add the next thing. The goal here, and the reason we're choosing to do it in these steps, is for the caramel, that is what that brown is on the outside of the meat, and the especially on the outside of the vegetables, because even though you don't see it, there is some natural sugar in the vegetables, carrots more than in celery. As that browns, that caramel is going to wash off of the food into the soup, and that's where the color and that deep flavor come from. So when you go to those places that serve, like, wow, that's just the best soup ever, how'd they do that? The hope is they did sound cooking practices as opposed to opening a jar with the base. Bases have gotten better over the years, but that is not an endorsement to use them. Sound cooking is the way to go. So we have our brown meat, our brown carrots and celery and onions and the other aromatics if you've chosen to use them. If you want to add garlic, at the last stage of the dry, hot heat is the time to add garlic. Same idea applies. Thinner things are going to brown much more quickly than thicker things, and all things being equal, garlic and carrots cut the same size, the garlic will brown and maybe burn before the carrot will. And let me tell you, burned garlic, well, there are a few things worse on the planet than that, and that's pretty darn bad. So, our base. The fond is in the pan, the meat is in a bowl, the vegetables are browning. Now what do we do? If the vegetables are starting to burn, we need to do something sooner than later to fix the problem, because burn is what we want to avoid. All of these steps up to this point have been to develop color on the food and a little bit of foundation in the bottom of the pan, which is that nice dark brown layer that's going to be the flavor base for our soup. If we see that it's getting too hot too fast, don't panic, but this is the time we need to add something that's wet. So if you are going to make a beef and tomato soup, this would be the time to add diced tomatoes. If you're making a beef mushroom soup, this is the time to add a little bit of oil and some of the mushrooms. The tomatoes and the mushrooms, even though they don't exactly look like it, are water. They have, obviously, tomatoes much more water than mushrooms do, but mushrooms, they hide their water inside their mushroom little mushroom cells, and as they break down, the water starts to come out. As the water is coming out of the vegetables into the pan, a couple of things are happening. The water is deglazing. That's the cooking term for washing that caramel off of the bottom of the pan and making it part of your soup or part of your sauce. The temperature of the pan is also dropping drastically. Since water boils at sea level at 212 degrees, all of that high heat that was being used to sear the vegetables and the meat to get that color, that's gone. So whatever didn't get seared is now not going to get seared, because we've got something in the pan that is in the form of water. It can be tomatoes and mushrooms are the most obvious. It could be some wetter vegetables. It could be actually putting in the stock. It could be anything that's going to make the temperature of the pan drop and water come into the pan. Once you've added your tomatoes or mushrooms, or if you're not using that, you've added your stock and the soup has come to a boil, you can add the meat to the pot. I would avoid seasoning at this point. And the principal reason for that is you can always add salt later, but getting salt out of a dish is, well, it's nearly impossible. And all of the old tricks of putting a potato in it or putting bread in it or adding sugar to it don't work. So the best solution to oversalted soup is don't oversalt the soup. You can always add salt at the end of it, and that's really just the best way to go. Once your soup is boiling, cut the heat down to a simmer. Now, simmer is the liquid is still moving. The full boil we're avoiding. And we're going to let everything just cook until when? Until it's done. It's the most frustrating answer in cooking is, how long does it cook? Cook till it's done. How do I know when that is? Well, the food kind of will tell you. It won't speak up. But when you go to your soup pot and take a fork, push it into the meat, if it's still not fork tender, and you know what that is, well, then it's not done. So it cooks longer. How much longer? I don't know. Until it's done. Some cooks who I've talked with, be it either professional cooks or just moms find the list of ingredients too burdensome. I don't know what this thing is. I don't know what that thing is. My store doesn't sell this, so I can't make the soup. And that's not an unreasonable frustration. If you're following a recipe and you don't know what fennel is, or your store doesn't sell fennel, or you can't find leeks, it could be an easy decision to just not cook. I can't find the ingredients I want. I don't know what to do, so I'm not going to make anything. It's not at all uncommon. What I think cookbook writers miss is giving cookbook readers permission to make changes. If there are things you can't find or don't want, and what kind of a substitution can you make? Can I double up the onions if I don't want to have leeks? Can I add more celery if I don't like carrots? Can I do one thing or the other if I don't like the other thing? The answer in all cases is absolutely, because this is your soup at your house for your family and the people you love. Nobody on a podcast or in text on a cookbook or on Food Network is in a position to tell you you can't do that. What's most important to me, and one of the reasons I had the idea for the podcast, was to break down the barriers that seem to get in the way of people cooking. If you don't want fennel, you can't find fennel, you don't want leeks, you don't want carrots, don't use them. That's not a problem. The problem is letting the fear of something some cookbook told you to stop you from doing the cooking. Let's fix that. So, don't want garlic? Don't use it. Want more mushrooms? Add more mushrooms. There are principles of cooking, browning, which we just talked about, even with substitutions, which should be followed to maximize flavor. Will the food police come to your house if you don't do that? Not at all. Let's say we're changing our focus from a beef vegetable soup to a chowder. Clam chowder would use clam broth and some milk. It's also going to use a roux. So the question of how do I use a roux to thicken my soup and not get lumps like grandma used to get in her gravy every Thanksgiving. Now, grandma did the best she could, and we love grandma very much, but lumpy gravy and lumpy soup, well, that's not good. So we can fix that. In the pan in which we've made our roux, there's a couple of ways to go. One of them is an extra step, and if this is more than you want to do, then go the single way. The extra step way is to make the roux in a separate small saucepan and then add that to the pot of soup. One of the real important considerations for using roux effectively, and that means using it so that we don't get lumps, is the temperature of the roux and the temperature of the soup need to be different by some decent degree. So if you've just made the roux, it's hot on the stovetop, milk from the refrigerator is definitely going to make that contrast create success for us. So hot roux, cold milk, that's what we want to have. If we have hot stock, then we want cold roux. But remember, this is kind of a relative thing. Since the milk is boiling somewhere around 212 degrees, if the roux is room temperature, then that's going to be different enough. In my own experience, I find greatest success comes from adding the liquid to the roux than the other way around. And I whisk small portions at a time. So if we're making our clam chowder, and let's do it all in one pot, we've got, say, an ounce of butter and an ounce of flour have been cooking for 1 to 2 minutes on low heat on the stove, and the roux is still nice and white. I'm going to add some of the clam broth to that pot and maybe a cup or two at a time, whisk that, and it's going to look kind of a bit of a mess. You'll see some lumps, you'll see some chunks. It won't look very thick. Let that broth come to a boil, so we may need to raise the heat. And as the broth starts to boil, the butter that has surrounded the flour will melt away due to the heat, and the flour will absorb the liquid. The reason we're using butter around the flour is to avoid getting lumps of flour sticking together, and also butter tastes good, so it adds a nice flavor to the soup. As the clam broth is coming to a boil, it's going to start to thicken. So whisk some more and add some more clam broth. If you've used all of the clam broth that the recipe asks for, and it says, hey, you're going to need some milk, you can add some milk at the end. This step, gradually adding liquid to the roux, is what I've used to the most success to make sure there are no lumps of any kind in my soup or my sauce, or even if you're making macaroni and cheese, they do the same thing. A little bit of milk at a time to make sure that we have no lumps. If you are making a soup that doesn't require a roux, or you're making a soup, say you're making a chicken noodle soup or a chicken broth soup or chicken vegetable soup, and you say to yourself, self, I kind of want this to have a little bit of body, but I don't want to go through the process of making a roux and then cooking the soup long enough for the roux flavor to be cooked out. Now, that's the thing. Let me tell you about that. Flour takes about 20 minutes to fully thicken a soup and also for the flour taste to go away. So roux are spectacular thickening agents, but they are not instant thickening agents. If you have this chicken noodle soup, this chicken vegetable soup, and you're thinking, yeah, it's really cold and I want some viscosity. Yeah, no one says that. I want a thicker soup. Well, one of the things you can do is mix equal parts of cornstarch with water, or if you have a thickener called arrowroot, which is a tropical root that's dried and ground and for all intents and purposes looks like cornstarch but does thicken better than cornstarch, mix that with water. That's called a slurry. When your soup is boiling, add just a little tiny bit at a time, and that will thicken almost immediately. I would let it boil a good 2 or 3 minutes afterward just to see the full effects, but then you'll see how little is little. Half a teaspoon. Start small. This is one of those things, just like adding too much salt, there is no real solution to fixing over-thickened soup that's been thickened with cornstarch or arrowroot. You have to add more water to it. The problem with that is, if the flavor was exactly what you wanted, and now you're adding more water, you're diluting the flavor, so the loveliness is gone. We may have properly thickened soup, but it doesn't taste like it was supposed to, and that's unhappiness. And unhappiness is easy to avoid by adding just a little bit at a time, and use a half a teaspoon at a time if you have to. If you're concerned that someone's going to bump you and bloop, then the whole half a cup goes in. That would be unhappy. We don't want unhappy. For a thickener that doesn't require starch, what can we do for, say, a cream of carrot soup? Well, I mentioned a minute ago that carrots have cellulose. Cellulose is kind of like a wood fiber, and it has a spectacular thickening ability, and it's pretty much in all vegetables. And just so we know, zucchini and yellow squash, they're fruits. We cook them like vegetables, but they're not. So we know this about potatoes. Potatoes have lots of starch. So maybe you wanted to make a cream of carrot or a cream of parsnip. You should do that, by the way. Fennel has some cellulose. Onions, less so than the woodier kinds of vegetables. Squashes, excellent for pureed thick soups. Now, let me just make an observation. If you have one of those handheld immersion blenders that's kind of like a culinary outboard motor, they go bzz, bzz, those are spectacular. Probably the easiest way to puree a soup is with one of those immersion blenders. If you are a little more old-fashioned and have, as I do, only a mixer that has the glass thing or the metal thing, well, that's fine too. Here's where the note of caution comes in. And do not fill your mixer so full. And how full is so full? 2/3 or more. Keep it about half full. When you turn the mixer on, sometimes mixers tend to want to spew their insides outside. Well, that's perfectly fine. It makes a big mess, but no harm done if you're making a smoothie in the morning. Lots of harm done if you're doing this with a very, very hot soup. Hot cream soups tend to stick, and hot cream soups which stick to skin burns skin longer than just water soups. So take great care if you want to. It's a good idea to put a kitchen towel over the top of your blender before you hit start, just to make sure anything that comes out doesn't burn, because burning is bad. The process of cooking the meat as we did in the beef soup may or may not be your choice in a chicken soup. I find that slightly darkened chicken soups have a depth of flavor that is preferred to me over just plain regular chicken soups. I will also, in a case like that, especially if I'm using bones that have been from a roasted chicken, I will go ahead and roast them a little bit to give them even more color and then make the stock from that. that. And I'll also roast my vegetables or saute the vegetables a little bit before I add them to the stock, just to help enhance that caramel color and that caramel flavor. The thickening part I probably would avoid just because I like a brothy chicken soup, but there's a way to get that brown color without necessarily browning the chicken, which you certainly could do. There are lots of ways to get to the flavor land we're looking to get. There are no real rules, especially when you're cooking at home. And I'm going to stress the real important factor is that cooking happened at home. The procedures are important, but it's more important to feed the people and feed the people with the fruits, so to speak, of your labor. And the best thing about cooking is, even if it doesn't come out great, people tend to like it. And there's lots of ways to improve, lots of room to improve, and that's just by practice, practice, practice. It's kind of the same way you get to Carnegie Hall. Browning the meat, browning the vegetables in the right order, making sure that the pan is not too hot so that we're burning the food, and adding the liquid things, tomatoes, mushrooms, stock, at the right time to get the flavor from the bottom of the pan in the form of all that brown yumminess. Oh, let me step back a second. If you are using herbs, if you're using dried herbs or spices, the best time to add them is at the end of the hot, dry heat. And for dried herbs, I would put them in a little bowl and add a little bit of water to them and make a paste. If you're using curry or even dried thyme or anything dried, make a little bit of a paste out of it with a little bit of water. The water is going to do two things. The first one is it's going to help lower the temperature of the stuff in the bowl. What that means is when you add that wet paste to the hot pan, the water is going to turn to steam first and help pull out the essential oil flavors that are part of that curry or the coriander or the thyme or the rosemary. It's also going to be a barrier from those things burning immediately. You throw curry into a really hot pan, pretty much it's going to burn. And, well, we've already established, burn is no good. That water serves the two functions of letting the oils and the flavors come into the bottom of the pot without burning. Then add your tomatoes or your stock. Same thing, same time if you're using fresh herbs. Fresh thyme, fresh rosemary, fresh marjoram, fresh oregano. Just before you add anything wet, put it in the pan. Now, the fresh already has water in it. That's the fresh part. So you hear it snap and it'll crackle and it might spit, and that's the flavor coming out into the oil, and then add your wet stuff. Now, if you were using something, say, parsley or cilantro or basil, those I would save to the end. And the reason is that they have nearly no oils compared to, say, the thyme, and so their flavors is volatile. That means that their flavor goes up with the steam. So when you add fresh basil at the beginning and cook it for several hours, well, the basil flavor is pretty much gone. And you may have said, well, see, I told you I can't cook. I can't taste the basil. Well, that's because no one told you what was the right thing to do. It's not your fault because you didn't get told right. You just didn't know. Now you do. Dry basil can go in the beginning because it's been dried. Fresh basil at the end. And let the heat of the thing, the dish, whatever you're making, that's going to be enough to pull that flavor out. And those last minute or so of cooking, so mint can go either way. Mint can go in the beginning or the end, but I like it at the end for it's a cleaner, fresher, unmuted kind of a flavor, which applies to the basil, cilantro, parsley. Depending on what you're making, oregano works that way. Chervil, tarragon, I think are better added at the end just because you get a brighter, bolder, fresher, crisper herb flavor than if you put them in at the high heat stage where all the flavors end up getting kind of muted. And that's not gospel, that's just my own opinion. I hope we have gotten at least a good start on basics for layers of flavor and building some foundations for a good soup or a good stock or even a good sauté of the meat. I mentioned, let's say you're sautéing a chicken breast for dinner. Well, the same principle applies. Sauté the meat, the chicken breast in the pan, get good sear on both sides, take it out of the pan and finish that in the oven or hold it off to the side for a moment while you add your aromatics to the exact same pan, a little bit more fat so that the aromatics can cook and they're coated in the fat. And if you're making, say, fennel, leeks, and parsnip sauté of chicken, chicken's browned. It's on a plate waiting for the vegetables to cook. Add the chicken breast on top of the cooked veggies, a little bit of broth or a little bit of water, or a little bit of cream maybe, but probably not at first. Cover that, add that liquid to the pan. Tomatoes would be an excellent addition here. So with mushrooms, cover the pan and let all of that stuff cook and give the pan a little bit of a whirl with your wrist or with a wooden spoon to get those brown bits off the bottom. Cover that so that the steam stays inside and you're going to help cook the chicken breast faster because we want done chicken. And then you've kept all of the flavor in the pan and that's all going to end up in your tummy and that's yummy, yummy. And what's wrong with yummy, yummy? Well, it's a question that answers itself, not a thing.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. If you want a good source for dried herbs or spices or spice blends, head over to culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice. Savory Spice mixes some impressive spice blends, which I use and love, and I know you will too. culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice.